the Castro Cinema, what it is, what it has been to the community here.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you for that wonderful introduction. Actually, would love to clarify one thing, and that is that the Castro Theater was actually built explicitly for movies. It was never anything but that.
Well, that's thank you so much. I wonder why that where that opera thing.
Let's clarify that now. There are plenty of theaters that were converted, but that one was built expressly for movies in 1922, and it was built by the Nasser brothers, which was this immigrant family from Lebanon. You'd actually be kind of surprised how many Lebanese families had come to San Francisco and started movie theaters. But they had owned, I think, about 6 or 7 movie theaters here in the city, including the Alhambra and the Royal Theater. But the Castro Theater was among those, you know, was part of their part of their empire. And over the years, you know, they'd, you know, as we know here in the city, cinemas have sort of come and gone. Coming into the 60s and the 70s, the youngest of the Nasser brothers, whose name totally slips my mind, he's really the surviving brother. He was running the theater. And essentially running it into the ground. I mean, they were showing third-run movies. I mean, and this is actually kind of hard for people to realize, too, knowing what they know now about the Castro Theater, that it was really just a neighborhood theater. It just showed third-run films. It was just kind of a junk heap, but just people talk about going to the theater and the light bulbs would all be out. It would be dark, even when the lights were supposed to be coming up. So kind of around that time, I think the Nasser brothers, the Nasser family, was thinking about actually tearing it down and turning it into an apartment building. And the idea was, really, they could probably make more money than on movies. Really, in the early 70s was kind of a bad time for films. They started actually leasing out the operation of the theater to Mel Novikoff, which a lot of people know as really kind of one of the great film exhibitors here in the city. He had the Surf Theater in the 60s, which was one of the first theaters that really featured independent films and foreign films in a really kind of an art context.
But where was that Surf Theater?
The Surf Theater was out on 48th and Irving. It is now a church.
Wow.
So you talk to anybody, they always talk about making that pilgrimage out to the Surf Theater to see Ingmar Bergman movies, Akira Kurosawa, that kind of stuff. So when the Nasser brothers were deciding that instead of running the theater themselves, that they would start leasing out the operations, Mel Novikoff was a person that stepped in. But also what he did was he began restoring the theater into the glory of what the previous era had left behind. And including in that, he was spearheading turning the Castro Theater into a historic landmark. And this is very bizarre. multimedia. What I want to say is he spearheaded turning the Castro Theater into a historic landmark, which then prevented the Castro Theater being torn down, you know. And then so between the preservation and it becoming a historic landmark, we have the Castro Theater for what it is today. And we have actually Mel Novikoff to thank for that. Fortunately, Mel Novikoff had died in 1986. But before he died, he actually started employing a couple of people to help him program. And one of those people was Anita Manga. Anita Manga had started at the Roxy Theater in 1980 with all those sort of illustrious people really creating repertory theater. She was doing the Roxy Theater. Then she came into doing the Palace Theater, which is no longer in North Beach, as well as what are some other ones? The York Theater, which was down in the 24th in Mission. So she has this illustrious history herself as being an independent programmer, repertory theater, that kind of stuff. So Mel Novikoff had brought her on. And then when Mel died, he passed on the business passed on the lease to the Blumenfeld brothers, the Blumenfeld Theaters, and they kept on Anita Manga. And the Blumenfelds had been operating the Castro Theater up until 2001 when their lease had expired, and Ted Nasser, who was he's the only son of the surviving original Nasser brothers, decided that he would take over the operations of the theater. Really the agreement was that he was going to keep the entire staff and keep Anita Manga on, which he definitely did, you know, because it was, you know, really, Anita was the person that really weathered the theater through some of the bad times of independent film exhibition. The 80s were pretty bad, actually, and probably saw the greatest number of independent theaters closing during that decade. So really, because of her, you know, a lot of people talk about how great the Castro Theater is, but it's really because of her that was able to give the Castro Theater its reputation of being able to get these independent films, great old prints that really no one else can show, these archival prints. And that's actually, you know, aside from the wonderful presentation at a place like that, that's one of the reasons why a lot of the festivals have their some of their shows at the Castro Theater. It's really because we're able to show, or the theater's able to show, some of these archival prints that really there aren't any other theaters in town that would be able to do that. So
that's great. So you can accommodate different kinds of media, as it were.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. You know, and it's like in this day and age, really there are no other places that can really show, that are really showing good independent films or foreign films with a blend of some repertory, which is never really a moneymaker these days in the age of the DVDs. But we're able to show, you know, like, these sort of revived prints and stuff like that, and there's really no other theaters that can do that kind of work.
They're really, really capable of handling a variety of media. They just probably get their films in the can, in the sort of 35 millimeter can, and then it has the optical audio strip on there, and that's about all they can accommodate. Right?
You stick them all together and just put them up.
Put it on, right. Well, that's what sort of the Castro was and what this great programmer, Anita, represented. Can you tell us sort of what's happened lately and a little bit about the new management that's sort of taken over at the Castro?
Yeah, so it's like, I guess it's new management, old management. We've got the Nassers back in the house. It's actually been, over the past couple of months, it's been kind of a little bit of a tough situation over there, where Ted Nassar has been vocally complaining about the attendance numbers at the theater, telling us basically that there aren't enough people coming through the door. Really, anybody could look at some of the independent theaters and even the not-so-independent theaters like Landmark and see that attendances are been a little bit shaky of late. But technically, if you look at the grosses from last year, the theater's actually doing a lot better than it did last year. We had a lot of great films this year, including, you know, the American premiere of the film The Corporation, which broke some box office records for us, not to mention the number of film festivals that come in and basically just buy the theater out, you know, which is, as the Blumenfelds used to say, it was kind of like just finding a bag of money on the ground. They didn't have to do much work. So, you know, including with that, you know, we had a great new print of La Dolce Vita, which we were having 700 or 800 people coming in a night to see that. That's almost unheard of in some ways. Keeping that in mind, Ted Nassar has been sort of grumbling about there hasn't been a good attendance lately. So he's been vocal in this. I mean, anybody could walk in off the street and hear him complaining to the staff, you know, these aren't good numbers. About 2 or 3 weeks ago, I had gotten a phone call from someone over at San Francisco State who works in the grad film program, and he told me that Ted Nassar had called up and wanted to know if there were any grad students that would like to would like the job of programming the Castro Theater.
Well, maybe they would do it for free as interns?
Well, clearly that would be the idea. Something like 6 or 7 months ago, the management, I was an assistant manager there, we were talking about how great it would be to have a technical director, someone that could oversee our special events, because a lot of times we have these events that have live performances and stuff like that, someone that could do sound, the live sound, and oversee both that as well as the projection booth. And Ted thought that was a great idea, but rather than talk to us or consult with the management or consult with the projection staff, which is a union staff, he actually made a posting over at the Academy of Art College and hired a woman who, hired this woman who may have seemed qualified in some ways, but even her references had told Ted that she wasn't actually, they felt worried that she wouldn't really be up to the task of doing what it was that he needed her to do. But he hired her anyway, and which created a really awkward situation for us during some of our events. A really nice person. She was great, but it was just kind of, she couldn't live up to what we needed her to do.
It was kind of like that new sort of middle management hire who doesn't have enough experience, but they're kind of thrust into this weird position.
Probably.
Deal.
Yeah, it was a little bit like that. But clearly, Ted, I think, wanted to save some money. So with a track record like that, getting that phone call from San Francisco State really, really worried me. On that same day, I decided to call Stacy Wisney, who is the manager of the theater, and told her what I'd heard. Now, that same day, she got a phone call from Elliot Levine, who had been the programmer at the Roxy Theater for about 10 years up until last year. He himself got a phone call from Ted Nassar, and Ted Nassar offered the job of programmer to him. And his response, of course, was, what's going on? You know, Anita Monga is probably one of the best programmers in the entire country, aside from being one of his best friends. What's the problem? So Ted kind of tried to back out of it a little bit and said, well, if it's not broke, don't fix it, which he said, of course, why? What's going on here? So in typical Ted Nassar fashion, he kind of skirted around the issue. Mind you, my friend who had called me from San Francisco State had told me that, you know, inquiring with Ted, if the person who had this programming job at this moment, he didn't know that Anita had this job. You know, does this person know that she'd be losing her job? And Ted said, no, she doesn't know she's losing her job, but please don't tell anybody. But at the same time, spread the word that we would love to have a grad student program. So from purely a labor standpoint, my friend was concerned. I was very concerned because I realized, you know, he wants to replace Anita Monga, but he's not really doing any real research into replacing her. So without going into too many other details, anybody who's been looking at the Castro Theater program lately would notice that we've had this children's film festival. We've had, I think the fourth one is going to be coming up, these Sunday kiddie matinees, Willy Wonka, Born Free, in case you haven't seen that one in a long time.
Willy Wonka? Poo-poo that.
Well, yeah, I mean, which actually did quite well. Now, the thing was, this was being programmed by Ted Nassar's wife, Karen Nassar, who stepped in, basically got everybody to commit an ungodly number of hours to making sure that this 12 o'clock show on one show on a Sunday afternoon did really well. So if they were concerned about money, you know, it seems a little questionable because, you know, we're not doing the work we're supposed to be doing. We're putting together flyers for Willy Wonka or for Cheaper by the Dozen, that kind of stuff. The last time I had a conversation with Karen after we were showing National Velvet, she was saying to me, and this was out in the lobby where lots of people could hear this, that she could program this theater better, and she was proving to me that by the numbers that were coming in the door, no, business is not better on the city. I can get people in the door. So essentially what she was saying is she could program the theater better than Anita could. Must also be said here that Anita had been trying to call Ted to find out if her job was in jeopardy, and he wasn't returning her calls for maybe two, almost 3 weeks, up until last Monday when he called her in to the theater for a quick meeting, and that quick meeting involved him reading off this little piece of paper that said, your services are no longer needed here. We appreciate your work. Thank you very much. This is the woman that's programmed the theater since 1986. So,
oh my God, he read off a script sheet to her?
Yeah, well, yeah, what else could he do? So she just said, you know, whatever my job, that's totally fine, but what's going to happen to the theater? At which point he kind of went a little crazy and started yelling and saying that, I'm a Nassar, I can do what I want, this is my theater. Which I guess you can, you know, when you've got a lot of money, you can behave like that, but that is the fundamental thing. What is going to happen to the Castro Theater? We have a calendar that goes up until December 16th, which Anita has programmed. She's already programmed a lot of films through the spring, even though the calendar's not out. Obviously, this is something she didn't know if her job was in jeopardy. What's going to happen? You know, Ted has publicly said, and this came out in the BAR last week, that he wants to program more family films and have more first-run films. Now, it should be understood also that the Castro Theater does program lots of first-run films. It's just that they're not mainstream films, typically. You know, the corporation, for example, or the clay bird, which came out of Iran. No, is that where it was from? I can't remember. You know, these are first run films. If Ted Nasser is talking about first run films, I can't tell if he's talking about Spider-Man. You know, is he trying to compete with the Metreon, which is would be a whole discussion in that capacity as well. You know, whether he's trying to compete with those theaters, which would be really impossible. You know, it was sort of Mel Novikov's vision, and it's something that Anita has kept going, is that the Castro Theater has unique programming. It has to. Really, there'd be no other way for it to survive.
Yeah, that's right. It has unique programming, and it's not afraid to play a lot of classics. You mentioned archival quality works before, but even stuff like 2001, Space Odyssey.
Yeah.
You know, to be able to see that on the big screen.
Totally. I mean, that's where these films were meant to be shown. So.
Yeah.
I mean, it's DVDs are great and all, but it really doesn't speak to what cinema is, which is going to this immensely huge venue and sitting in a really public place but having a strangely private experience, you know. So it's just not the same, really.
Yeah.
So that being said, what's going to happen to the Castro Theater? You know, without a venue like the Castro Theater, that's, I don't want to even say that that's one less place where films of this nature can play, because there's so few venues that they can play at as it is. So with that future in doubt, who knows what's going to happen? I mean, for filmmakers, independent media makers, you know, there's just, that's, the audience is just being cut off at that point, or at this point. So, you know, it's hard for me to say what's going to happen. I mean, without spreading too much gossip, but 5 days before this last calendar went to print, Anita got a phone call from Ted Nasser, who had a mock-up of the calendar, and he called her specifically about two films that were on our program, Bruce Weber's film A Letter to True, and Jonathan Cowett's film Tarnation. He was concerned about the gay content in these films.
Oh my God!
Now she had to really kind of step forward and, you know, really kind of defend these films. Bruce Weber has made two very high-grossing films that we've had at the Castro. Let's Get Lost, which was an Academy Award.
Oh, I love that piece.
Was it an Academy
Award? Chet Baker.
Exactly. Right? It was at, I can't remember if it won the Academy Award or it was a nominee at least. And then lesser known was a film called Chop Suey that came out, I think, last year, the year before. Very gay film. Gay in the sense, sort of gay aesthetics, really kind of talking about, you know, it's not so much like looking at naked men or whatever, but really kind of lounge music and all this kind of stuff, kitschiness, how it fits in. So we had this new film. Really, it's about his dog, True Blue, but it was also an anti-war film. So at the same time, well, what is gay content? There's some Dirk Bogarde home movies in it, which I guess you could say is gay. There's an interview with Liz Taylor about her dogs. Is that gay? You know, I don't know. Jonathan Cowett, who is gay, made this film about really being a survivor of abuse. And people that live in the Bay Area, you'll know that about 2 weeks ago, that was the cover story in the Bay Guardian, which was really this great amount of press. It also had gotten a lot of press in the New Yorker as well as the New York Times, and two articles in the Chronicle. So Ted was very concerned about the gay content in these films. So she had to really kind of like say, look, you know, these films will do really, really well.
Right. I mean, obviously springboard off of all of that publicity.
Yes.
You know? And,
exactly.
And pitch off of that to more people to come.
Wow. I mean, if people knew that, you know, the Castro Theater doesn't just show gay films. It's in a gay neighborhood. But, you know, that's part of independent filmmaking, is, you know, speaking from the margins or whatever, even though gay cinema has become a lot more mainstream. And we also host, actually, what's I think is the third best attended film festival in the entire country, Frameline's Lesbian and Gay Film Festival, which we host every year. And we've hosted since 1980, I believe. So that's not a moneymaker. I don't know what is. So I don't exactly know what Ted Nasser has in mind when he's concerned about gay content. And what is family entertainment? I don't know.
And why, of all places?
The Castro Theater.
The Castro.
Yeah,
come
so,
on.
You know, so I think this this really speaks to the eternal problem of people that have money and they just don't know what a place like the Castro Theater means to so many people, what it means to the culture of the city. I believe it was Jewel Gomez who wrote maybe a couple years ago that out of any place in the city, the Castro Theater is probably the largest crossroads of different cultures here in the city. You know, its movies speak to so many different people, and with so many different film festivals that appeal to different interest groups or cultures or ethnicities, there's no other place like it, really. So the problem is Ted Nasser just does not know what it means to people. But the problem is, too, you know, they're family's probably paying these property taxes on this theater. I mean, they go back to 1922. They probably aren't paying that much money. So even if they just shut the doors of that place for a year, I'm sure it would be, they would probably save money or something like that. So they can do what they want with that theater, unfortunately.
Well, Christian, here I am sitting here in San Francisco listening to you tell me this, and I've got $10 in my pocket, and I think I'm going to go see a movie tonight. Where, besides the Castro, could I go and see a movie on a single screen, independent cinema?
Well, that's a really good question. Obviously, we're here on 16th Street, and there are only two theaters in the vicinity. The Roxy, which actually just opened its second theater,
The Little Roxy, yeah.
Right next door. Well, that's probably one of the last here in the city. They've programmed, you know, independent films like the Castro, not of the same magnitude, but they've been doing it since, 1976. Actually, interestingly enough, we haven't really figured this out yet, but the Roxy Theater might be the oldest cinema here in the city. I believe 1907. The Roxy, that compared to the Clay Theater, which is up on Fillmore Street, built the same year, but nobody knows exactly which opened first. Now, down the street, about a block from us here, is the Victoria Theater, which is this beautiful old theater that actually opened as a vaudeville house.
Lovely, where the Unembedded film series is currently playing.
That's
across the street.
Yeah, yes. which is another great theater, independently owned, owned by the Correa family. They don't program films 7 days a week like the Castro or the Roxy does, but they're also a great live venue, so they can really they have a better ability to have mixed events there, from comedy, live theater, live music, and films. And they often host a lot of different film festivals as well. Up in the Haight, there is the
Red Vic.
At the Red Vic Movie House. The ATA. We'll mention the ATA. The Red Vic Movie House, collectively owned and operated.
That's right.
And we love them. They've premiered many a film that we love.
Of ours, yes. The three collaborated on We Interrupt This Empire.
That's correct.
Premiered there at the Red Vic. And I should also mention that Mark worked on Boom, The Sound of Eviction, which had its premiere at the Roxy. So some of these independent cinemas you're talking about have provided venues for us.
Yeah, but they're supporting not just local cinema, but they're always supporting independent media, really. We've got the ATA, which is not really a traditional movie theater, but, you know, it's a storefront kind of thing. I think beyond that, well, we've got the Balboa Theater, which has been operated by Gary Meyer, who was the person that started Landmark Cinema before it became a big corporation. Didn't know that. Yeah, at the UC Theater, they started Landmark. He's been operating the Balboa Theater, which has been predominantly second run out there on Balboa at about 38th Avenue.
Where we're having to get some infrastructure over to the Victoria.
Really?
Right now,
as we speak, for the
Unembedded Film Festival. And I just sort of mistakenly brought our deck in here to use for my Eclectique Politique radio show.
What a mistake.
I know, but...
So just to kind of finish up on this topic, I think that really encompasses... Well, actually, no, I shouldn't say that. Frank Lee, who operates the Four Star Theater out on Clement Street, who just recently purchased and is renovating the Presidio Theater out on Chestnut Street. He's renovating into a three-screen theater. Again, he's an independent operator. As maybe some people know, that the Four Star is under threat of being closed because his lease is coming up next year, and it's going to be converted into a church. It's owned by a church, and so there's an effort to save the Four Star from being converted. But he's another independent owner-operator. And, you know, it's a well-known theater, not just for having independent films, but he also hosts an Asian film festival, usually about 2 weeks long, which happens every August. So from there, I mean, we start looking at, well, Landmark Theater, which sort of has a, yeah, we don't have to talk about that, you know, but really the state of independent film exhibition, which is as important as independent film, you know, it's being able to go out and be able to see these films and support the filmmakers that are making them. So
it really is. And in terms of, you know, political awareness in the culture, documentaries are doing a great service right now.
That's
correct. They're providing, you know, content that's just being completely ignored by the mainstream press and other types of broadcast mediums, and so the only place you can see a lot of things are through these independent documentaries, and if there's no place for them to screen or show, obviously that's a problem, and fewer of them are going to get produced. And so that really sinks from my, you know, strictly political point of view, but even just...
From many points of view, really. Just, you know, the less venues there are for these films, really... like the less opportunity for these films to get made. You know, it's like, you know, people, the digital age has empowered people to become their own filmmakers, but really we need places to show this work, you know. So without them, you know, it's the audience is getting cut off from the makers, and it's nothing that I think DVDs or, you know, satellite television, all that, you know, it won't fill in that gap enough.
Well, one place you can find out some more about these venues that we've been talking about is, well, that I know of, is on the Video Activist website, videoactivism.org, and under some of our resources, and there we have a page about screening and venues that screen independent work here in the Bay Area. So be sure and check that out, and I'm sure there's other places online to learn about these independent venues.
And also, I
know of any?
Well, I would like to actually encourage people to not only patronize these independent theaters, because, you know, they need our business, because they're really not being supported by the mainstream press. You know, reviews in the Chronicle, they always slant more towards the blockbusters. And really, how do people know about these films and these theaters is a lot of times through, you know, the mainstream newspapers. So really go and seek out these theaters and really, you know, give them your money. It's part of the culture here in San Francisco. And I also encourage people to write a letter to the Castro Theater at 429 Castro Street, San Francisco, California, 94114. And just tell them, you know, just tell them how important it is that a theater like the Castro Theater maintain the quality of its programming. And tell them how much you love the programming. Or tell them how much you love to be able to go to the Castro Theater, a beautiful old theater like that, that programs films 7 nights a week, to have that kind of experience that, you know, sooner or later is going to be gone. So let's try to keep it as that. So, or you can email them as well at Castro Theater, and theater spelled T-H-E-A-T-R-E, at AOL.com, and drop them a line and let them know that you support independent film exhibition.
Wow. Thank you so much, Christian Bruno. Would you like to talk about anything that you're currently working on, or?
You know, it's funny that you mention that, because actually, for the past couple of years, I've actually been working on a film about movie theaters here in San Francisco. So now that I've just been fired from my job at the Castro Theater, I think I may have cut off one that little access point. But the film is looking at San Francisco and the movie exhibition environment, starting from the early days of the Nickelodeon up to the present day of multiplexes and what have you. But it's a way of looking at how the city has changed over the years. Not only am I looking at the change in film exhibition practices, but how there were movie theaters all over the city at one time, and really how that really kind of spoke to the diversity of the city. How did cities change over the years? What are the forces? And I feel like movie theaters are a way of representing those changes, looking at those changes. So I've been interviewing film theater historians, people that have worked in movie theaters, people that have programmed movie theaters. Also, next month, I actually have an interview with Mike Davis, the author of Dead Cities and City of Quartz, who is some...
Cadillac Desert? No.
Wrong guy. I'm bringing him in to really talk about how cities, you know, have been treated by the federal government and how they've changed over the years. Also, someone I'm going to be interviewing, hopefully in the next couple of months, is James Kunstler, who wrote the book Geography of Nowhere, who has been traveling the country and trying to figure out what the hell's happening to our country.
God, that's really – this all kind of plays into the sort of urban dystopia.
Exactly.
Know, or suburban dystopia, where it's lots of watered ivy and – you know, stucco and strip malls.
For certain. I mean, in California is a great place. All you got to do is drive up and down the I-5 and see how, like, the outskirts of L.A. is just basically growing up through, you know, the Central Valley. And soon we'll all be part of this massive suburb, you know, which is just nothing but these crazy gated communities.
Are they calling Phoenix East L.A. now?
It's very close. You know.
I took that drive. I think it's I-10 that goes directly east to Phoenix.
And it just doesn't end.
And we did that as a kid. And I remember doing that as a kid. And sort of like you left L.A. and there was just nothing. And it was just, I loved it. Just these big skyscapes and desert views and very barren, a feeling of barren.
Oh, sure.
And then suddenly, you know, you pulled into Phoenix and it was like, oh, you know, let's stop in this roadside diner before we go, you know, somewhere else. But then I went just recently, I don't know, about a year ago, and it was like L.A. just kept on going.
Kept going.
We went over the San Bernardino Mountains, and
yeah.
And it was going and going. But finally it stopped for a little while, and there were some wind tunnel things in the desert and stuff like those wind-generating
nature
things in the desert and stuff. But then we started pulling into the outskirts of Phoenix.
Like so soon.
Yes. And the outskirts of Phoenix had come westward, you know, so it was this urban sprawl, you know, it's just uncontrollable.
It's, you know, yeah, and part of it is, and this is being addressed by my film, it's just like, it's interesting because I had this conversation with my dad recently talking about public transportation, and I was just in Boston riding the T, and he was like, well, you know, without subsidizing these bus systems, these things would just totally fall apart. They're money losers. And I could only think really that automobiles are being subsidized by the government. You know, gas prices are technically pretty low. Our tax dollars go into these freeways. Yeah, and, you know, we're subsidizing the war that's making this oil more available. So, in a way, I think the illusion of, like, private transportation versus public transportation is really just that. It's just an illusion, and it's not really going to last. And actually, James Kunstler, as I mentioned, he's really feeling like he's been writing a lot about this lately, that, you know, the oil economy is just going to bottom out within 5 to 10 years. The suburbs are going to be laid to waste. You know, I know that lots of people have been talking about this as of late, but really we've got to get back more into sort of localization.
Right. We have to arrange our whole urban structures to support better, more efficient distribution.
Certainly.
Not so petroleum dependent, all that kind of stuff.
So, and, you know, it's in, again, you know, bring up Mike Davis, you know, he's really been sort of examining how, you know, in our two-party system, you know, the Republicans' constituency is like the suburbs versus the Democrats, which have been more urban. But really the truth is, really since the 90s, actually since maybe even the 80s, the Democrats have been really speaking more to these suburban Democrats and really kind of leaving the cities out in the cold, you know. So, you know, I guess, though, you know, the dot-com boom really made urban living kind of attractive to the young moneyed class again. So, but really that was really not for the better, you know, unfortunately.
No, and it too is kind of a myth, because it's kind of based on this idea that you can have all the sort of cool cultural experiences that come from being in a dense urban environment without having any of the undesirable aspects.
Certainly. But I mean, also, you know, it's people come here from the suburbs and they bring their car and they just drive their car everywhere. And it's like, I know the public transportation system isn't great, but, you know, you don't need to make that drive three blocks to go pick up your groceries and that kind of shit.
Well, that comment by your dad, that's a comment that people in my family would also make. But it's really, I mean, I hate to say it, but it's kind of naive because there's just so many ways in which the automobile and the oil culture is subsidized here, and there's so many forces propping up our whole society around that, mm-hmm. and the way you're supposed to shop and the way you're supposed to
get
from work and home and all that kind of stuff, and there's just so many things working, you know, against any kind of planned mm-hmm. urban structure, you know, that involves public transportation, and it really makes a huge difference, like you say, like being able, that's why I live in San Francisco, really. And I wouldn't have been able to live here so long without, you know, the help of, well, BART, you know, bad BART, but, you know, I use it, and I actually saw on KQED, to its credit, recently, a show about the old trains that used to go across the Bay Bridge,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
trains going across the Bay Bridge, up over to Martinez, I think, you know,
yeah,
going north,
sure. yeah.
over to Marin County, and all this stuff was conjoined by these trains, and they were incredibly efficient.
It was actually a very phenomenal system, and, you know, it basically got dismantled with the idea that it was going to be replaced with something, but,
right.
you know, I'm not positive about...
I knew about the trains, and
yeah.
probably a lot of people knew about the trains being dismantled down in Los Angeles.
Yes, right? Exactly, and they were being bought up by automobile companies.
We've all heard that, you know, Firestone or...
Yeah,
you know,
for sure.
Goodyear and Chrysler, you know, GM and all these people...
Concerned about public transportation, as
right,
always.
You know, buying up the train system and then paving over it.
Yeah,
you know,
just like replacing them with buses and then, you know, making bus service completely undesirable, you know.
But yeah, it happened here.
It totally did, yeah.
Yeah. Well, the other part of how your dad's statement was kind of neat is that it doesn't take into account how certain things that are publicly funded can be just neglected to the point where mm-hmm. they just sort of wither away, and then everyone says, oh, look, it's failing.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, look at that. Oh, public schools, look, we haven't,
yeah.
you know,
it speaks to so many different things.
You know, public schools are failing. Oh my gosh, you know, we have to privatize them, you know. And this is the same type of logic here. You know, if we had the will and the desire as a culture, we certainly have the technology.
We certainly do.
We could do it. We could make public transportation more a part of feature of our environments, and also that would also lead to less alienation for old people, young people.
For certain.
Because right now, you know, everybody's in their own little ton of metal moving around from point A to point B. They're not talking. They're sitting there being marketed to,
yeah.
and they're isolated. And for old people, this is especially problematic because, you know, it leads to this sort of warehousing of the old people where you kind of have to take them off and dump them somewhere
yeah.
before you go commute to
I
work.
I mean, there were definitely parts of the city, South of Market, for example, you know, when the whole Moscone Center, Yerba Buena district was being, you know, imagined, you know, way back when in the 50s and the 60s, I mean, the South of Market, yeah, might have been crummy, but it was mostly, you know, single room occupancy hotels that were occupied by retired, you know, laborers, you know, and families and immigrant families. And when you read about this and... You can read about that. I can't remember the author, but City for Sale, you know, talking about the basically something like 4,000 people just got bulldozed out of South of Market.
I think that was Rebecca Solnit.
No, it wasn't Rebecca Solnit. That's Hollow City. City for Sale is, I cannot remember. It goes by the subtitle also, Transformation of San Francisco. And it's actually a great work. I cannot remember the fellow's name. I apologize. But, you know, he goes into detail about this that, you know, mostly these retired people who are living on fixed incomes, you know, they could have a pretty full life, and there's no reason they shouldn't because their community was there. People, they could take care of themselves. They could walk around the places that they would frequent. There were movie theaters that they could go, restaurants that were cheap, that kind of stuff. But, you know, again, to maybe to look at it, I mean, that land was obviously too valuable for poor people to be living on, you know, and they were literally bulldozed out of there in a long struggle. And I think the Census Bureau has only really been able to account for something like a quarter of the people where they went after that. I mean, these were people who were like in their 70s and their 80s. There was no place for them to go. Where did they go? You know, that's an important question. And you talk about that, you know, the warehousing of our old, you know, it's like they deserve a social life. They deserve to be able to, you know, take care of themselves in a certain instance, you know.
Yeah, and they also deserve access to young people and to little kids. And
yeah,
stuff.
And we deserve access to them as well, you know.
That's right. That's so right. And
but we don't want to be, we don't have, they don't want us hanging out with old lefties and retired longshoremen. They might give us some bad ideas.
That's right. That's right. Well, I just hate this automobile culture, but I don't know what to do about it.
Well, it's tough because everything is geared towards the automobile, and I mean, I think automobiles are okay. I mean, there's a certain use for them, but I think their usage is just well beyond what they're needed for, and it's unfortunate. Again, you know, people move to the city, they want the urban experience, yet they want to live like they're in the suburbs, and really, you know, we don't need, you know, big bookstore chains and stuff like that. Go to the suburbs for that. It's like, what's great about the city is that independent businesses can usually thrive here because people want that kind of diversity. But you don't, there's so many forces that sort of lead into that. But, you know, you just can't be coming to the city wanting an experience that's just a complete illusion of what, like, why you came here to begin with.
Yeah, right. And you can practically live your whole life and never have to leave the mall anymore. There's like the Mall of America where you can work and live and shop. And
well, that's the America is becoming the Mall of America. So.
Right. And so if that's, you know, 90% of the rest of the landscape of the country, please leave this little island alone.
I know,
this little cultural
I know
island.
Just let it be. Let it be.
Can't we do it? Can't we just leave it alone? My gosh. So, well, thanks so much, Christian, for coming by.
Thanks for having me, Jeff. I've had a great time.
Appreciate having
you. On Electronique Politique?
Well, hey, it may as well be. Electronique, no, it's eclectique, which is probably a word I've invented. It's a play on eclectic, which means a wide variety of styles.
Hey, thanks for clarifying.
And sure, man. Thanks for coming by. And is there anything you'd like to hear, any requests?
You don't have any movie music, do you?
Movie music.
Do you have like any soundtrack?
I do have some soundtrack stuff. It's going to take me a minute to boot it up here because once again, it's convenient technology. DVD
has prevented you from being able
to spontaneous. There's no, you know, give me tape. I love tape. You know, you play, you put tape in and you press play. DVD thing, you wait. Oh, it's loading. It's queuing. Do you ever notice that? I hate that.
Keep it analog. Keep it locked in here at Electrique. Chronolique.
Electric Chronolique Radio is happening tonight on Enemy Combatant. Occupant is joining us once again. He's here in the studio. Other people from Whisper Media and Christian Bruno. And so we'll be going to some music here, and I think we'll maybe hear a little sample, a little pirated sample from Wattstax's DVD. Great soundtrack. Can't recommend that movie enough, which you can get on DVD, by the way. So it's not just one big, you know, cultural vacuum out there in the world of DVD. There are some things that are becoming available to us because of DVD. I know I wouldn't have been able to get the 16mm film of Wattstax and show it to myself. So
hey, good point.
But anyway, here we go, and we'll make that transition.
She to up when he said, he called me Rajagada.